Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the United Nations Conference on Climate Change, at which President Obama warned the world leaders gathered in Paris that time is running out to deal with global warming before it is too late to reverse its catastrophic impact on the planet. Jody Freeman, who served as Counselor for Energy and Climate Change in the Obama White House, joins us to discuss the critical role of executive action in the face of a Congress that is trying to roll back modest gains in clean energy for power plants, which is the least challenging and most attainable goal compared to what a global regime to combat global warming will require. Then we'll look into the psychology and sociology of global warming denial that hit a six-year high in the U.S. in 2014, with 23% of Americans not believing in global warming and 53% not believing it is caused by human activity. Dr. Riley Dunlap, a professor of sociology at Oklahoma State University and one of the founders of environmental sociology, joins us to discuss why 53% of Republicans in Congress are global warming deniers, along with many of the Republican presidential candidates, and how much the public get their cues from political and media elites. Then finally, we'll examine the underreported fact that 30% of the world's carbon emissions come from land misuse and industrial agriculture, and speak with Jeff Biggers, the founder of the Climate Narrative Project at the University of Iowa. We will discuss his recent article at the New York Times, Iowa's Climate Change Wisdom, and how the adaptation of wind and solar energy and carbon sequestration in soil makes Iowa an important example for the U.S. at the United Nations Conference on Climate Change in Paris that opened today. And joining us now is Jody Freeman, the Archibald Cox Professor at Harvard Law School and the founding director of the law school's Environmental Law and Policy Program, the co-author with Michael Gerard of Global Climate Change and U.S. Law. She also served as counselor for energy and climate change in the Obama White House from 2009 to 2010 and was the architect of the president's historic agreement with the auto industry to double fuel efficiency standards. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jody Freeman.
Great to be with you. Thanks.
And the president made a pretty powerful statement at the gathering of all the world leaders in Paris today, where he said, "I've come here personally as a leader of the world's largest economy and the second largest emitter to say that the United States of America not only recognizes our role in creating this problem, we embrace our responsibility to do something about it." So it's pretty clear that he's trying to basically say to the haves, we've created this problem, and to the have-nots, it's not your fault, but we're going to help you out, and we're all in this together. Do you think that's going to bridge the divide?
Well, I think the president's trying to set a tone and trying to establish early on that he's prepared to lead. It's a huge part of his legacy, climate change now, and he's running out of time. He's only got less than a year, and this meeting is very important to cement his legacy. I think there are very high expectations about the Paris meeting for good reason, because the problem is urgent. But I think it's important to know what will be achieved here and then to think about what probably won't be achieved. So we already know a great deal of what the agreement will look like, because the major economies of the world have already made their pledges about what they're going to do. The U.S. has made a pledge, China, the European Union, India, all of the major economies have committed to cut their emissions or reduce their emissions intensity. So there are no surprises there. These are all voluntary domestic commitments. But there are many other things that are yet to be resolved, so we should be looking for some really hard negotiations on a few items. For example, the review and monitoring system for these pledges. You know, what's the transparency regime going to look like to really hold countries to account for their pledges? Another issue will be financing. How much money will be set aside by the developed world, largely by government, but also by private actors, people like Bill Gates, for example, to fund mitigation and adaptation in the developing world in order for them to transition to a cleaner energy economy? And the final issue, which is very contentious, is whether there will be an additional fund called Loss and Damage Fund, which would really be compensation for the countries that are going to be hardest hit by climate change, really a transfer of wealth from the developed world to the developing world. So we've yet to see these things play out, even though we know what the pledges will look like, and so there's still some excitement to watch for in the next couple of weeks.
And the president did admit that the irony that, of course, the countries most vulnerable to the effects of global warming are some of the poorest on the planet. But the figure of 2% 2 degrees Celsius is coming up, of course, in terms of the targets and the challenges in terms of mitigation. Apparently, the trajectory that the planet is on, it will lead to about a six degree Celsius rise, which would be totally catastrophic. So when you talk about these targets, how much are they tied to that? They have to be tied to that goal, don't they? And 2%, right. We're at 1.8 now, so that's going to be very hard to hold it to 2%, surely.
Well, the ultimate commitment here is really from the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change, which was agreed to long ago, over 20 years ago, in 1992, which set as the goal to prevent dangerous human interference with the climate. And that has become the 2-degree centigrade target. That is not to let global average temperature go beyond 2 degrees, which would lead to very significant changes in terms of, you know, storm, sea level rise, radical weather changes, and various other very serious impacts. So that remains the goal, but you're right to be a bit skeptical, because everyone who's looked at the pledges made so far for the Paris negotiations agrees that even with those pledges, they would not amount to keeping the temperature below 2 degrees centigrade. But I think it's important to put that in perspective, and that is this negotiation is really about creating a framework for the future. The idea is that this is a launch. This is not the end of something. This is the beginning of something. And what the governments at the negotiations will be doing is creating a new system for making promises about domestic action and holding each other to those promises over time. And they're putting in place a transparency or monitoring system so the countries will feel the political pressure to hold to their commitments. And the wish and the hope and the ambition is that this will lead to ratcheting up the commitments over time, and we will get in the range of the 2-degree Celsius target eventually. Nobody thinks that will come from this meeting alone, but what they hope is that this puts us on a path to a transition to cleaner energy globally.
And again, I'm speaking with Jody Freeman, who's the Archibald Cox Professor at Harvard Law School and the founding director of the Law School's Environmental Law and Policy Program, the co-author with Michael Gerard of Global Climate Change and U.S. Law. She also served as Counselor for Energy and Climate Change in the Obama White House from 2009 to 2010 and was the architect of the President's historic agreement with the auto industry to double fuel efficiency standards. And in terms of, in the opening I mentioned that the necessity of executive action here, because the president is already being undermined by the Congress in terms of what he's trying to do on what are the most attainable, as far as I can see, targets, where the stationary sources of pollution like coal-fired plants are manifestly clear what they do, the damage that they do. There are alternatives, a bridging alternative being natural gas, and solar and wind are also being proven, starting to come on. They should have come on a lot of long ago, obviously, but that's the reality. And here you have a Congress that is undermining him at every turn. So,
yes, there's this very interesting dynamic as the president appears in Paris today to kick off the negotiations, and there's a soaring speech and very ambitious and hopeful language. At home, Congress is very busy undermining him to make sure that the message is sent that there are many foes and opponents of any climate deal. Congress is right now, even today, was meeting to decide whether to vote on blocking the president's new rules that regulate power plant emissions, which you just talked about, a historic effort to cut greenhouse gases from the oldest and dirtiest power plants in the country. And the Senate has already voted to block that new rule. The House is about to join the Senate. And if that happens, the president's going to have to veto this resolution in order to keep those rules alive and in order to make sure they get implemented. So they're doing this at the very same time, really, to try to undermine the president. They're also considering funding bills where they have discussed the possibility of blocking any spending if any part of it is going to be devoted to the Green Climate Fund, which the president has pledged $3 billion toward. That is the financing mechanism, kind of like a World Bank mechanism to finance mitigation and adaptation in the developing world. The president has said, we're going to do our share, we're going to contribute $3 billion. There's probably, I think, $10 billion that's been pledged so far. And he says, we're going to contribute to this, but the Congress is prepared, perhaps, to block spending bills in order to hang up this funding. So there's a series of events at home politically that are playing out that really underscore the president's strategy here. He has all along said the only way to make progress on climate change in the current political climate in the U.S., with such opposition in Congress among the Republicans, who, you know, all of whose presidential candidates deny the basic science of climate change, which is an astonishing fact. What the president has said is we need to use executive action. Every part of the president's pledge toward cutting emissions that he has presented in Paris depends exclusively on executive action and not on Congress. And what he's seeking is an international agreement that is not a treaty. What he's seeking is an executive agreement that he himself, using executive action, can implement, and that a successor president or presidents can implement in order to avoid ratification in the Senate. So this is executive power, as you said, Ian, all the way, and it's because he's facing such opposition in the Congress, especially among Republicans.
It's extraordinary, though, that you just mentioned that all of the Republican candidates for president are Global Warming deniers. I had given them the benefit of the doubt and assumed that some weren't, but
Let me amend that just to say skeptics who think there are two sides to the issue at best,
right?
Which is really an astonishing and embarrassing fact for the greatest country on earth, with, you know, the best universities on the planet and the home of Silicon Valley and the most incredible technological innovation in the world. You know, for this to be our representative of our Republican Party is really something that we should be very concerned about.
Well, I in the opening, I mentioned this new poll that says 23% of Americans do not believe in global warming and 53% do not believe it's caused by human activity. I think probably we are alone in the world, are we not, in terms of the number of deniers and the center of gravity for denial, as opposed to, I mean, what I've always found extraordinary about this issue is, and I've talked to lots and lots of scientists involved in the research, that 97% of scientists see the reality. Scientists are the most conservative people on the planet. They don't get out ahead of their data. You know, it's hard. I've interviewed them. It's like pulling teeth to get them to say something definitive.
Yeah.
Isn't that bizarre?
I know you'll talk about this later on the program, and so I won't take up too much time on it. But it is a problem, you know, and it's part of a really concerted effort and campaign to sow the seeds of doubt on something on which there is an overwhelming scientific consensus. But I think the international negotiations are trying to push through that skepticism and say, look, we take this seriously, the governments of the world take this seriously, and we're actually prepared to commit ourselves to a long-term plan. I mean, I think the message of these negotiations is not that everything will be resolved in the next 2 weeks in Paris and, you know, climate change will be stopped in its tracks. That's an unrealistic goal. But rather, I think the message is, look, the time for short-termism is over. You know, we need to develop new legal frameworks, new technologies, and build new markets to make clean energy a reality, to make a transition possible, not in the next 5 years, but in the next 30 to 50 years. And Paris is a launch for that. It's the beginning of that process. Recognizing that we as a global community are still going to depend on fossil energy for quite some time. I mean, we have population growth, GDP growth, global energy demand is probably going to double, some say, by 2050. There's no question we'll need coal and oil to power major economies of the world, but the challenge is, how do you transition to a greater share of renewables? How do you transition to a greater share of non-fossil energy like nuclear? How do you use energy efficiency to offset some of this demand? And there's tremendous potential for all of these things. And this is what Paris is about. What is the framework for us to move forward toward this transition?
But you've just presented an extraordinary challenge, Jody Freeman, and that is that if energy is doubles in the next few decades, and at the same time we're trying to keep it down to 2 degrees Celsius, and it's at 1.8 degrees Celsius now, you've got all the stuff being poured into the atmosphere, and the demand for the very stuff that's causing the problem is going to double. That's a Herculean task, isn't it?
It is a big challenge, that is for sure, but, you know, there are some very bright spots here to point to. You know, for the first time, not only the developed world, but the developing world's major economies, like China, like India, have actually pledged to cut their emissions or stabilize them. China has pledged, for example, to stabilize their CO2 emissions, to peak them by 2030. And these commitments from all of the major economies of the world are new. You know, years ago in the Kyoto Protocol, it was only the developed world that was prepared to cut or reduce their GHG intensity. So that's very significant. And in fact, when President Xi and President Obama stood up together and made joint announcements, not just one, but two very significant joint announcements about leading the way toward addressing climate change, that's a game changer. That has never happened before, and they are the two indispensable nations. I mean, that's 40% of the world's emissions, and China is taking serious steps in the direction of trying to peak their emissions, and they are the world's biggest investor in renewable energy. They've made a commitment to 20% non-fossil energy by 2030, and you know, I think China is very serious about this. They are not setting themselves up to be embarrassed on the world stage. So even though the challenge is very, very great, I think we are in a position now with the U.S. and China at the helm to really see some very significant progress.
And indeed, back home in Beijing, President Xi must know that the people can't breathe the air today.
Yes.
So just in the last couple of minutes then, if you could frame this argument, I know it's fanciful, but if you could say that the Islamic State terrorists were behind global warming, you'd suddenly have a consensus. So is it possible that, I'm talking about here domestically,
yeah,
is it possible that you could bring this, it is such a national security issue. I've talked to all the intelligence people, the generals, et cetera. They all say this is a number one security issue, global warming. Can that be the wedge to get these deniers to stop their obfuscation and starting to deal with reality?
Yeah, I think it's very important to stop thinking of climate change as a partisan issue. You know, it's not a left or right issue. It's a question of energy security, as you just said. It's a question of safety and preventing us from having to spend a lot of money, billions and billions, indeed trillions of dollars, to deal with the outcome if we don't take affordable action now. And I think it helps that the national security experts acknowledge the seriousness of this challenge. It helps that the military has very clearly acknowledged that climate change is a threat multiplier. They have said this publicly, testified, written many reports. I think we have to break out of this idea that it's a left or right issue and talk about it as a technology-based challenge, a transitional moment, an opportunity for the U.S. to lead and to make money on clean tech and innovation. I think when we start to have that conversation, we will get out of this trap we seem to be in, which has framed this as one of these cultural issues that you have to pick an extreme side on. I think if we see it as a scientific challenge, technological challenge, we can break out of that, out of what is really a box that we're stuck in.
Well, Jody Freeman, I thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Jody Freeman, who's the Archibald Cox Professor at Harvard Law School and the founding director of the law school's Environmental Law and Policy Program, the co-author with Michael Gerard of Global Climate Change and U.S. Law. She also served as counselor for energy and climate change in the Obama White House from 2009 to 2010 and was the architect of the president's historic agreement with the auto industry to double fuel efficiency standards. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into the psychology and sociology of global warming denial.
There's been a crash on the levee, and mama, you've been refused. king and his queen for queen. It's gonna be the meanest flood that anybody's ever seen. Whoa, mama, you're gonna miss your best friend now. You're gonna have to find yourself.
If it keeps on raining, that beast gonna break. If it keeps on raining, that beast going to break. When the levee breaks, have no place to stay.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Dr. Riley Dunlap, is a professor of sociology at Oklahoma State University and one of the founders of environmental sociology, a field established in the mid-1970s. He has served as president of the International Sociological Association's Research Committee on Environment and Society and as chair of the American Sociological Association's Section on Environment and Technology. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Riley Dunlap.
Thank you, Ian.
And in terms of the problem itself, let's define the problem of climate change denial. Apparently it hit a six-year high in 2014 with 23% of Americans saying they do not believe in global warming and 53% saying they do not believe that global warming is human-caused. And you have a number of presidential candidates on the Republican side running as global warming deniers, Donald Trump, I believe Ted Cruz, Marco Rubio, I'm not sure the others as well. And, of course, in your state, Oklahoma, Senator Imhoff, I think he believes, does he not, that global warming is a hoax?
Well, he's on record as saying that. Yes, he is.
So there's the problem. Now, what's your sense then of, is this to do with what Al Gore's titled his film about, An Inconvenient Truth? Is it because it's just so much easier to believe that it's all a hoax and it's not real, then you don't have to deal with the inconvenient truth that we're going to have to change our lifestyles radically, as is now being discussed in Paris?
Well, I think there's a good deal of that. Actually, in recent years, as the Republican Party has moved to the right, I think it's become even more complex. I mean, we've also always had this strong push, and everyone points to ExxonMobil with good cause, by the fossil fuels industries to deny climate change because of the implications for their future economic performance. However, as the Republican Party has just become so anti-government and so anti-regulation, the regulatory implications have become, you know, just like anathema to them. And so it's this blending of economic interest and ideological commitment, you know, this kind of neoliberal hatred of all government regulations. You put those two things together and you've really got a powerful brew that, you know, some politicians are going to deny climate change because of the contributions they get from oil companies. Others are going to deny it because of their staunch anti-regulatory ideology, and many for both reasons.
Well, I think in general, though, we have a bigger problem in our culture here in the United States, and that is that there's no consensus about what is true or what is real. People do their own reality shopping, and conservatives get their reality from Fox News, liberals from MSNBC, Christians from Christian Broadcasting, etc. So how much is that a factor in this, that, you know, we basically are in an age where people can choose their own reality?
Yes, well, there's certainly a great deal to that. What's often called the conservative echo chamber has really done quite a job in making climate science controversial, you know, calling, again, as Inhofe put it, a hoax and so forth. But we need to keep in mind there's a, I like to put it, a quote, real reality, and you simply can't create your own reality. But this is one of the big, big accomplishments of the climate change denial machine, which is a term a lot of us use. They have basically relativized climate science. For some people, I think it's, again, for economic reasons. But then when it ties in with the Christian conservatives who deny evolution, you really have an issue here where a great deal of America simply won't face up to the realities of physical science evidence.
So is the press also here at fault, Dr. Dunlap, in the sense that we have this binary notion of equal and opposite arguments? You have the Democrat argument, then the Republican one, that in the universe of discourse, there's two equal and opposite opinions. And that has allowed, for example, you mentioned creationism and denial of evolution. In other words, the creationists argue that their opinion is just the equal and opposite argument, that you have to give equal time to. And I guess the same is happening with global warming, even though 99% of scientists say it's real. So has the press in its convention contributed to this problem?
Oh, unquestionably. I think we have this long tradition of false equivalents. Yeah, and there's just knee-jerk tendency for so much of the press to get an, quote, expert on one side and another on the other side. And, you know, you'll often hear, you'll have a really well-published, highly credible scientist from a major university speaking, and then he or she is balanced out by someone typically who works for a conservative think tank and is just paid to put out propaganda. And it's quite dismaying to me personally that the press simply refuses to point out how off the wall and how at odds with reality a great deal of what we hear about in climate change is. But there just seems to be a tendency to want to stay in the middle no matter how far the debate shifts to the right. And it's actually quite stunning, and I think it's quite harmful to public discourse.
Well, a lot of people, you know, get comfort from religion, for example, and it seems to me that that's a normal human tendency to seek it out and interpret facts in a way that confirm your pre-existing beliefs. And I think it's much harder in life to be a skeptic, or even a cynic for that matter, than it is to be a believer, because once you're a believer, you know, you get rid of doubt and anxiety. So as a sociologist, walk us through this journey, if you will, where confirmation bias turns into motivated reasoning and emotion-based decision-making processes take over, in which people cling to false beliefs and ignore any opposing evidence. That's the framework that I understand, but I don't understand the journey.
Yes. Well, you know, you kind of hit the human psychology aspects of it. You know, clearly people do have these ideological biases. We all have those to some degree. And a key factor in evaluating information then is going to trusted sources. And that's where things have changed so much, because the conservative echo chamber with Fox News, right-wing talk radio, and all the bloggers and so forth have truly created an alternate reality on many issues, you know, whether it be the economy or foreign affairs or so forth. And again, so much of the press treats this as equivalent. But, you know, MSNBC and Fox News are not equivalent. One of them tends to correct itself when it makes mistakes, and the other just puts out, well, many would say propaganda, and never corrects itself. And I'll leave it to you to choose which ones I'm talking about there. But here's a sociological perspective on this. You talk about the motivated reasoning and these things, and the psychologists have done a good job. You know, people only listen to the sources they trust. They just you know, blank out or block out information that's not consistent with their views and so forth. But what is missing from that psychological perspective is, where do these frameworks come from? And this is where a new study, actually two related articles by a young sociologist at Yale called Justin Farrell, just published last week, do a magnificent job. He clearly documents how entities funded by ExxonMobil and the Koch brothers put out material that questions climate science, and that in turn gets into the media, it gets into the halls of Congress and so forth. But it also then becomes the framework by which lay conservatives automatically reject climate science. And it wouldn't have to be that way if they weren't taught this, so to speak, by people in power, economic power, political power. I like to point out, if you were to go back to Theodore Roosevelt, you know, one of the founders of the conservation movement, very progressive Republican. Someone like Theodore Roosevelt in the Republican Party, if there were such a person, would point out that climate change is a threat to our nation, the most fundamental values, and we need to do something about it. Instead, we have, you know, conservative think tanks, the conservative movement, the conservative echo chamber, telling people, no, it's just a threat to the economy. It's a right, it's a, you know, left wing hoax, et cetera. So it's where the framing comes in. You know, individuals weren't born with these denial themes in their brain. Someone had to supply them. And that's where sociology adds an important dimension to the psychological studies.
But I'm mystified as to why there is this growing mistrust of scientists in this country. And the idea that scientists would lie or exaggerate it flies in the face of scientific method. I've talked to lots of scientists, and it's like pulling teeth because they're so conservative. They're by nature conservative. They don't get out ahead of their data. That is just not in their DNA. So I'm astounded that they're getting this bum rap.
Well, this is one of the huge successes of the climate change denial movement. They have gone after scientists because the evidence is so overwhelming in favor of the reality of global warming and its negative impacts. They have to, going back to our earlier conversation, they have to attack the sources of this information, and that's the scientists. And what the denial the machine has done has perverted the notion of climate science, made it out to a hoax and so forth. And a really key element is this. They've lost the debate within the scientific realm in terms of peer-reviewed publications and so forth. But the big accomplishment is that they've turned a scientific controversy into a public controversy. In other words, they've made climate change look controversial in the public realm. Fox News, the Wall Street Journal, talk radio. And that's a subtle but hugely important shift. And once you take a scientific debate out of the realm of science and put it out there in the social realm, then they can do things like this. Not only do they attack scientists and say, oh, they just say this so they can get grants, but then they can overcome this near consensus by saying, hey, both sides deserve a hearing. Minority views must be respected. Well, these are things that we believe in the normal realm of political discourse, but when it comes to scientific reality, everybody's views are not the same. You know, those with the data and the evidence carry the day. And the denial machine has just gone after climate scientists because it served this purpose. It's changed it from a scientific debate to a public debate. And in that sense, it's been a great victory for them.
But it seems to me that this anti-science, growing anti-science bias in the country is not limited to conservatives and the right wing. There are a lot of people on the left that are against vaccinating their children, against animal research, against genetically modified food, etc. So, as I say, this is not exclusively the province of the right. Maybe global warming is, but not the rest of science denial that's out there and the gravitation towards health and spirituality and quackery and conspiracy. Conspiracy is a huge growing cottage industry in the United States.
Well, there's an element of truth in what you say there, no question. But I also think it goes back to a bit of false balance. Some new studies coming out, like Larry Hamilton, a sociologist at University of New Hampshire, for example, has pointed out that this anti-vaccination orientation, which admittedly seems to have come out of the West and, you know, more liberal folks, has been adopted by a lot of the right-wing folks, and it probably is as strong, well, it seems to be even stronger among the right-wing now than where it started. The anti-GMO, it's hard to tell where that's going and how much damage it will do. I will say this. I don't think those debates are nearly as consequential or have nearly as much to do with the future as does the debate over global warming. So you can come up with some studies, and I certainly recognize this, that people on both sides of the spectrum have their biases and there's an element of anti-science. But I personally don't think the evidence is strong that it's equal on both sides. And here's the most important point. The folks concerned about GMOs and so forth don't have this huge echo chamber out there. They don't have that many people in Congress. They don't have a bunch of think tanks. They don't have the Koch brothers, et cetera, funding them. So they end up having far, far less consequence than the people denying climate change, human-caused climate change.
Well, as the Gospel according to St. John says, you shall know the truth, and the truth shall set you free. Just in closing, is there ever a possibility? Do we have to get to the point where the truth is that your house is under ocean water and your fields are awash with seawater and you're all clamoring for higher ground and shooting each other over a can of tuna?
Well, I certainly hope it doesn't get to that. And in fact, a really hot topic among behavioral scientists now is to what degree will perceptions and beliefs concerning climate change alter as people experience more extreme weather events, changing weather patterns, and so forth. There are some people who are very optimistic and think that lay people's views are going to shift as they see various anomalies. Other people go back to the things you were referring to, the motivated cognition and so forth, and feel that the ideological commitments on the right may be so strong that conservatives simply aren't going to accept the reality of climate change, no matter how much it hits them in the face. And to be honest, I think the evidence is out at this point.
Well, Dr. Raleigh Dunlap, I thank you very much for joining us.
Well, thanks for your questions. Appreciate it. Opportunity to chat.
And again, I've been speaking with Dr. Raleigh Dunlap. He's a professor of sociology at Oklahoma State University and one of the founders of environmental sociology, a field established in the mid-1970s. He has served as president of the International Sociological Association's Research Committee on Environment and Society and as chair of the American Sociological Association section on environment and technology. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into how global warming denial is not happening amongst Iowa farmers who are embracing solar and wind. Thank you. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Jeff Biggers, a writer in residence and the founder of the Climate Narrative Project at the University of Iowa. His latest book is Donatio Memoriae, and he has a recent article at the New York Times, Iowa's Climate Change Wisdom. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jeff Biggers.
Thanks so much for having me back, Ian.
And I was fascinated by your recent article in the New York Times that reveals something that I wasn't aware of, that even if every coal-fired plant shuts down, land misuse still accounts for an estimated 30% of the world's carbon emissions, and the soils in the United States, like those of nations around the world, have lost calamitous amounts of carbon. So, you know, we were talking earlier with an expert on this subject who served in the Obama White House, pointing out that in this Paris conference how important executive action is, simply because we have such a disgraceful Congress that is in the pocket of dirty coal, and they're even trying to stop modest attempts to clean up energy generation with these stationary sources from coal-fired plants, which are literally the low-hanging fruit. But now you're talking about something else, so explain, if you will.
Sure, certainly. You know, it's what we're referencing, of course, Ian, is the impact of industrialized agriculture and misuse of massive feedlots. And really, the state of Iowa is sort of a poster child for that. You know, no state in the union has been altered like Iowa. We've lost over 99.9% of our native prairie. And, of course, remove that to create these massive fields for commodities and industrialized corn and soybeans and massive feedlots. And that's really resulted in an incredible carbon footprint that we often underestimate and don't really pay attention to. You know, meanwhile, the loss of the soil organic content is catastrophic in many senses. You know, we've lost anywhere from 50 to 70% of the original carbon content on a global level in terms of our world soils. And this is carbon that is not coming back. This is up there. And we have to somehow restore these soils, these native habitats, to bring back this kind of soil carbon. So it's a huge issue that really is going under the radar right now, even in Paris.
And that's despite the fact that the United Nations General Assembly declared 2015 to be the International Year of Soils, a global soil carbon sequestration campaign.
Exactly. You know, we give a lot of lip service to these international sort of designated years, the Year of Soils, of course, being this year. And you do have countries, of course, like France, who put out a very unique initiative. It wasn't a binding initiative, but they called it the 4 per 1,000 initiative, where they asked for a voluntary action plan to improve organic matter. And basically what they're saying, if we can encourage farmers to have a transition to what we're calling agroecology, agroforestry, forestry, conservation, landscape management, essentially to bring back the native habitats, then we could begin the process to stop the present increase in atmospheric CO2 and start to capture some of that carbon up there in our soil.
Well, what was encouraging about your article in the New York Times, Jeff Biggers, was the extent to which Iowa, which of course is a key state in the primaries, where it seems a handful of evangelicals are setting the entire national agenda, and you get the impression that it's a deeply conservative state, but not so when it comes to dealing with global warming.
Exactly. You know, it's very ironic. You know, I think that most people in the nation don't realize that Iowa, in fact, is really one of the main national leaders now in the wind industry, that we get almost 30% of our electricity from wind turbines, which is really incredible if you think about it, Ian. At the same time, you have this new movement towards solar energy that had been unleashed by a recent Supreme Court decision, and it's really taking off first in the rural areas. I think what I've really noticed is that you have more solar panels on the barns and feedlots of conservative farmers than you're going to find in any urban areas or suburban parking lots. That, you know, at the same time, they're seeing this shift to renewable energy. We're having very little discussion about it. And that is what is very heartening to me about being now based in Iowa, is that you see people are approaching a transition, they're approaching climate action, not from a political perspective. You know, these are, in the end, very conservative people, but from a common sense perspective, that it's just simply the right and most cost-effective thing to be doing right now.
So you don't have climate change denial, then. That's not going on in the state, that the farmers know what's happening. And I guess the farmers are seeing it firsthand, aren't they?
Exactly. You know, we're going through bouts of drought and flooding, droughts and flooding that's beginning to have an incredible impact on their yields. You know, and I think people who are ultimately attached to the land have, as we often refer to as the frontline perspective of what's really happening now with the future of climate change. You know, I looked at one farmer in particular, a young man in Johnson County, and he was someone who got his ag degree, began to go into a conventional farm, and then realized it's not what he wanted to do because there wasn't going to be a future for him a few decades down the line. And this is a young man who just turned into his 30s. In the past 3 years, Ian, he has planted more than 30,000 trees, introduced cover crops, composting, multi-species grazing, and he's transformed a once degraded industrial corn farm into a really vibrant carbon-capturing ecosystem. You know, and he's not doing this only because it's an amazing thing for climate action and soil carbon sequestration. He's also doing it because he feels like this is really the farming of the future if he's going to have a future as a farmer in the heartland.
So is there any kind of cross-fertilization, if you will, between the farmers of Iowa and the extent to which they're embracing alternative energy, wind and solar, and alternative agriculture, as you've just described, and these presidential candidates, particularly on the Republican side, many of whom are global warming deniers who are traipsing around the state?
Exactly. You know, and I think my frustration is more with the media, because living here in Iowa, when you see sort of the Circus Maximus come to town, you know, it tends to be a focus on the quick sound bites and the most outrageous topic of the day. You know, and we're so focused on the conservative social issues of abortion and gay rights and issues like that, which, of course, are extremely important, but I feel like they're given exaggerated importance when, you know, just on the other side of the street, you see a lot of very important climate action and, you know, restoration work at play. And I think it's incumbent on us now as the media, and this is what drove me to write this piece for the New York Times, is to say, you know, we need to start telling a different climate story, a different climate narrative. We need to be breaking into the national media and saying, hey, wait a minute, if you're going to come to Iowa, there's a much more important story we need to be telling now, especially as the global leaders are meeting in Paris as we speak today, dealing with climate issues.
So is there a movement? I mean, you're telling us that the facts on the ground are changing in Iowa, but is there a movement like of farmers for the future?
No, it's hard to quantify it, but I would say definitely in the past few years that I've been following this issue, you've seen an incredible rise of young farmers who are returning to the land to do what we call regenerative agriculture. That it's not an issue of buying into the conventional corn and soybean agriculture of the past, but they really are looking at ways in which they can restore the lands and make a living by returning the land to what it once was. And at the same time, you know, do like this young farmer is doing, planting thousands of trees that not only will provide fruits and crops, but also provide a future for their own work. So it's hard to say, but at the same time, I really have to say there's a noticeable increase in a return to the land of these young farmers who really are pursuing this regenerative approach. And this, to me, it's very hopeful, because I think the big issue for me now in Iowa is not climate denial. It's climate cynicism. It's people who feel like either it's too late or there's nothing we can do or the political lobbies are too great that we can't ultimately stop big coal and big oil. And I think what we're seeing here is completely a different story of people who are going around those typical narratives and just simply doing it in the dusty soil.
But my understanding is that agribusiness imposes its sort of will on agriculture in this country, and that's why you have this kind of homogenized monoculture of, you know, you can drive for a whole day through a lot of the Midwestern states and all you see is corn. You know, I mean, one of the oldest things about crop rotation is that you're not supposed to keep planting the same crops in the same soil. You'll deplete the soil. And I assume that because there's so much monoculture going on in the country at the behest of big agriculture, factory farming, that you have to replenish the soil with all kinds of fertilizers that largely are petroleum-based. And then, of course, on top of that, you've got all the pesticides that go along with it. So isn't that the cycle that we're living with? And I'm curious to know how these young farmers in Iowa, they must be butting heads with big ag.
Oh, completely. And I think you're completely right. And I don't want to downplay the role of big corn and industrial agriculture here in the heartland. It's a lobby as powerful as the coal industry from where I'm from in southern Illinois. I think we've also seen the incredible role of industrial agriculture to convince Democrats to march with them on this whole ethanol craze in cultivating even more corn to burn in the ethanol plants as so-called green energy. So I don't want to downplay the reality of the industrial agriculture and its lobby. But at the same time, I think the writing is on the wall that if we continue in the way that industrial agriculture has done, the yields are going to continually decline, and there's going to be rougher and rougher reality for the typical American farmer, both from a corporate level to a small family farmer. You know, I think last year Bloomberg came out with a study called Risky Business, and they actually focused on the Midwest and said, really, the great American farmer in the heartland is facing some of the most dangerous realities of the future because of flooding, because of drought, because of more flooding and improper water management, the decrease in yield, the increase in costs. You know, that ultimately it's not going to be cost-effective for a lot of these major corporate farms to continue. At the same time, you're seeing an incredible backlash, Ian, in the cities. You have the city of Des Moines, which right now has a groundbreaking lawsuit. They're actually suing farmers upstream for the amount of nitrates and chemicals that come through the watersheds and gets into their water supply that they have to spend millions of dollars every year to clean and run through their treatment plants. And they're basically saying, hey, we're not going to put up any longer with the discharges of industrial agriculture. And so here you have a major capital in the Midwest taking on in the industrial ag. So a lot of things are changing. And I think what I see as important is that we begin to find incentives for these young farmers, for the people who are doing regenerative agriculture, people who are returning to the land, to create a ripple effect to have even more of an impact than they are today. There was a white paper released just last year by a pioneering institute called the Rodell Institute. They're really the pioneers of organic farming. And according to this white paper, which is still slightly controversial, but according to their research, if management of all the current cropland worldwide shifted to a regenerative agriculture model similar to the young man I described before, then more than 40% of our annual carbon emissions could be captured. You know, and so this is a huge statement to make, that if we really provided incentives to increase our soil organic content, like the French want to do in Paris, like the Rodell Institute is talking about, like young farmers are doing in Iowa, then we truly could be on the cusp of a major revolution here in the heartland. And that's the kind of story I think we really have to be following right now.
But when you have this dichotomy, or even battle line, if you will, between regenerative agriculture versus industrial agriculture, and clearly regenerative agriculture is where the future has to be, because I imagine industrial agriculture is what's causing us to lose all this amounts of carbon from the soil.
Exactly. Oh, entirely. Industrial agriculture and, of course, you know, these massive feedlots and whatnot. But I think, and that's why you need examples like this young man whose farm is called Versaland and many others. You know, when my piece came out in the New York Times, my email box for the next few days was just packed of farmers from around the country who wanted to basically talk about their own regenerative ag and their own restorative farms and what they're doing. And so I don't think he's unique. I think this is part of a trend that is growing every year that really is beginning to turn the tide, I think, in many respects in the agricultural field.
Well, just again, for the benefit of our audience, can you give us a quick primer into the idea of why it's so important to have increased soil organic carbon stocks as opposed to industrial agriculture that releases calamitous amounts of carbon?
Well, for two reasons, you know, both the below and above. Right now, even if we shut down every coal fire plant, still, you know, 30%, at least 30% of our carbon emissions are just coming from land misuse, coming from industrial agriculture and feedlots. You know, so there's no placebo effect, and just we can't simply say, okay, you know, we're magically going to shut down every coal fire plant and the problem solved. Because meanwhile, 50 to 70% of the carbon that was in our soil is gone now, and we have to capture that. We somehow have to find a way to capture the CO2 that's in the atmosphere. And I think that's where we have to return to nature itself. And I think that's what we're trying to do here in Iowa, is to begin the discussion to show people that soil carbon sequestration, the way of capturing, you know, the carbon can happen through natural process of literally of growing trees and prairie and the native habitat that once held that carbon, you know. It's a very basic, simple approach, but at the same time, it has just really profound implications of how instead of trying to do less bad, we can begin to actually enhance and heal the damage we've done in the past century.
And if you were to return the land to its original state back in the days of the Native Americans, would you be able to have the same productivity in terms of food production?
You know, I think there's plenty of examples and studies that have been shown, Ian, that regenerative organic farming is equally as productive as the conventional farming, especially when you start to consider all the externalities of costs that are included, anywhere from the massive amounts of chemicals and pesticides and fertilizers and the mechanizations of these farms versus a more organic farm that doesn't have any of those costs. You know, that sort of self-maintained or uses more integrated pest management and whatnot. So, I mean, I think there, yeah, your listeners really have to go out and begin to do their own homework, that, in fact, I think we can see the same kind of yields that we need through a more organic system.
Well, Jeff Biggers, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thanks so much for having me, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Jeff Biggers, who's a writer in residence and the founder of the Climate Narrative Project at the University of Iowa. His latest book is Damnatio Memoriae, and he has a recent article at the New York Times, Iowa's Climate Change Wisdom. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me. Scroll down on the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.